weeks ago, I was at the Dublin Buddhist Centre, and they had also asked me to give a talk on ordination. But I think I suggested it. I'd said, oh, I'll give a talk on ordination and the dharmic significance of that. And when I got there, I discovered that they had called my talk Blowing the Heart Open. So that was a little surprise for me, that they had called the talk Blowing the Heart Open. And of course, they'd taken that title from the line of the poem we heard earlier, Seamus Heaney's poem Postscript. We're going to hear that again in a minute. And I was really pleased, actually. I was really pleased that they'd given, even though it was unbeknownst to me, that they'd given the talk on ordination that title. The more I thought about it, the more it kind of sort of fitted in a way. The more I thought, oh yeah, I think some of what's in this poem can help me trying to talk about what ordination means, especially this first part of the ordination ceremony, the private, what we call the private ordination ceremony. So I thought before we go any further, we could just hear that poem again. And Tony's very kindly offered to read the poem. I really wanted someone Irish to read the poem. So Tony's going to come and stand here and read us.
Highly qualified. Okay, so it's Postscript by Seamus Heaney. And sometime, make the time to drive out west into County Clare, along the flaggy shore. In September or October, when the wind and the light are working off each other, so that the ocean on one side is wild with foam and glitter. And inland among stones, the surface of a slate-grey lake is lit by the earthed lightning of a flock of swans. The feathers, ruffed and ruffling, white on white, their fully grown, headstrong-looking heads, tucked or cresting, in or busy on the water. Useless to think you'd park and capture it more thoroughly. You are neither here nor there. A hurry, through which known and strange things pass, as beat soft buffetings cometh a car sideways, and catch the heart off guard and blow it open.
Thank you, Tony. That was lovely. I feel like I don't really want to speak now. Beautiful, beautifully read and really beautiful poem. Yeah. So I love that poem. It's a fairly well-known poem of Seamus Heaney's. It comes from his book The Spirit Level, published in 1996, and it's particularly well-known for that last few phrases, and particularly the last line, catch the heart off guard and blow it open. And I'm also interested in the first line of the poem, actually. The first line is, and sometime make the time to drive out west. So you've got the end, this something that catches you by surprise, catching the heart off guard and blowing it open is a responsiveness that you can't plan in advance. But at the same time, you do have to set up the conditions, and I think you get that in the first line where it says, sometimes make the time to drive out west. You've actually got to do something. You've actually got to drive out west. So I'll be sort of coming back to both those ideas, that you have to set up the conditions for something, and then something happens that you can't plan for. During the talk. I think it's interesting about that poem as well, that it's called Postscript and it's the last poem in the book. So again, those things about it also say to me, it's a very similar thing, that you, first of all, you put the effort in. So in Seamus Heaney's case, it's as if he's put the whole effort into writing the whole book, And then you've got this postscript at the end, kind of like an afterthought, something that comes after all the effort. And then even for the reader, you know, you've put the particular effort into reading the book, because it does take effort to read poetry, doesn't it? And then you get this kind of, you get lifted into another dimension by the last poem. It's a bit like, I think, like the end of a meditation or the end of a puja sometimes, especially the end of a puja, you know, that lovely silence that sometimes happens. You know, you've kind of, there you are, you've tried your best, or maybe even not tried your best in the puja, but it seems to work whether you've how much effort you put in, that then at the end it's just this lovely silence that's deeper than an ordinary silence. It's not just the absence of sound. And if you can just be alert to that, and that's the kind of moment of grace at the end of the puja, or sometimes when the final bell goes at the end of the meditation, you get that kind of postscript feeling. Something's caught off guard in that moment. Something unbidden happens. So as I say, I was very, very pleased that the people in Ireland sort of, when I said I'd give a talk on ordination, obviously thought of this poem and thought that they were somehow connected, because it made me think more deeply about, well, what is the connection? So hopefully the rest of the talk will explore that. So about a month ago, I made a journey out to Spain. It was quite a long journey. It took 2 days to get to where I was going. And where I was going was to the top of a mountain. It was a really very sort of rugged, remote place. And when I got to the top of the mountain, I met a bunch of other women who were there. They'd been there for a good couple of weeks already. They were all dressed in blue. I was dressed in blue as well, and the people I went with were dressed in blue. So there we were, a bunch of women, all dressed in blue, up a mountain. Some of them had been preparing for this. Well, all of them had been preparing for this for quite a long time to be there. Some of them had been consciously preparing, that is, for 3 or 4 years. One of them had been preparing for 30 years to be up on the top of this mountain, dressed in blue, and just for an outside observer would have looked like all they did was got up, walked to another room, sat still for quite a long time, walked back, ate some food, and kept doing that throughout the day, and sometimes went for little walks. Later on, after a week or two of me being there, actually it was raining nearly the whole time I was there, but one day the sun came out, but on the day the sun came out, instead of going out sunbathing, all of us went into a room and stayed there the whole day, chanted some words in an ancient language. At some point, each of them came forward one at a time and had some drops of water poured on their head. And later on, then they got one of these white ribbons put round their neck. And later on, it was discovered that each of them had a new name. So an outside observer might have thought, what on earth are they doing? Like, what on earth are they doing? And I must confess, sometimes I thought, what on earth are we doing up there, up this mountain, doing all that? So you might have guessed that what these women were doing was they were having their ordination ceremony, which some of them had prepared for a very long time indeed. And that this day of extra special ritual marked, well, the second part of that, the public ordination bit that Jan Vach is going to talk about next week. The chanting that was going on, at least in part, was the chanting of the refuges and precepts, which, instead of the 5 precepts that we often chant here, the 10 precepts were chanted. But not only that, it wasn't just that 5 had turned into 10, those refuges and precepts were chanted now as vows. They were chanted as ordination vows. The ceremony involving drops of water was a purification ceremony. The white ribbon was this white kesa. In fact, it's we wear these because we don't wear robes, and it's the belt. It's what would be the belt of a robe. I only found that out recently. That in traditional ordinations in ancient times, this would have been the robe. This would be the belt of a robe, but it would be placed around the neck of the people getting ordained. So this kesa, as it's called, is kind of in, well, not exactly in lieu of a robe, but we don't have robes at our ordination, but we have this. And then the new name signifies that all these people having their ordination, some of whom will meet in 2 weeks' time and then more in 4 weeks' time, the new name signifying that, well, this really is a spiritual rebirth, a dharmic rebirth, that this whole ceremony that might have looked slightly strange to any outsider really was an initiation into a new life, a significant stage in the Dharma journey. Not the end of the Dharma journey by any means, in many ways the beginning of the Dharma journey, but really, really significant stage. And I was reminded of some lines, and people might know the sort of epic poem, The Light of Asia, which is the life story of the Buddha written by Edwin Arnold, sort of Victorian poem, quite romantically written. And he describes the Buddha at the time of the Buddha's going forth, and he says it like this. He says, this is in the words of the Buddha, as if the Buddha's speaking. Unto this came I, and unto this all nights and days have led me. So I really resonated with those lines. Unto this came I, and unto this all days and nights have led me. Like everything in the whole of one's life, and the whole of the Buddha's life in this case, had led him up to that moment of going forth. And it resonated with me, those lines resonated with me, because I remembered that I had felt something very, very similar on the night of my own private ordination ceremony 19 years ago. And so this morning I searched and actually managed to find my diary excerpt for that day, June the 14th, 1995. And this is what I wrote. Actually, this must have been the morning when I knew I was going to have my ordination that night, actually. I think I wrote this in the morning. So I wrote, in meditation, a strong sense of being true to myself, my childhood aspirations, my longing years of my early 20s, my initial faith in the Dharma. Today I'm taking all these aspirations, longings, and stirrings of faith and putting them on the best path, the path that will lead to their fulfillment. I know this with no doubt in my mind. So something, I felt that was, I don't know, but I felt that there was something similar in the expression. I had a very strong feeling of, oh yeah, this is what my life's been leading up to. And this is, I can put everything here and it won't fail me, as other things have perhaps failed me in my life. So hopefully I'll draw this out more in the rest of the talk as well. So what I want to draw on for the rest of what I want to say, kind of fairly unashamedly, I'm drawing very, very heavily on a talk given by Subhuti, actually a series of talks given by Subhuti last year at one of our retreat centres, Padmaloka. He gave about 8 talks on the 5 stages of the path, of the Dharma path. And I particularly want to draw on the talk he gave for the stage of spiritual rebirth, and also a bit on the stage of spiritual receptivity. So what the Dharma says is, what are Yeah, what the Dharma says is that for an enlightened being, the Dharma says it's possible to become enlightened, and that for an enlightened being, life would be experienced quite differently than an unenlightened being, yeah? And that for an enlightened being, life would be experienced as a spontaneous unfolding. And there'd be nothing getting in the way of that unfolding. Particularly that we ourselves would no longer be getting in the way of that unfolding. The thing, what gets in the way is our tendency just to continually circle back in on ourselves, back in on our selfish concerns, basically, while we're unenlightened. While we're still unenlightened, sometimes we get a glimpse of that tendency being slightly loosened up. Especially going on retreat, for example, like Jnanavacha said, we get a glimpse of, I'm not quite so tightly circling in. But it's a bit, certainly on my experiences, even if I have that experience, it's a bit like I'm on this bit of elastic that kind of stretches to its limit and then sort of boings back in again, and then I'm sort of boing back in, I'm in the selfish concern again. So for an enlightened being, it would be like the elastic's broken, and there would just be this spontaneous unfolding. You would completely be unrecognisable to yourself anymore, because you wouldn't be, you wouldn't be sort of tightly spinning back in. So that's the Buddha's vision, if you like, that spontaneous unfolding, that is possible for any human being. But you can't force it. You can't force yourself into that state. You can only set up the conditions for its unfolding through all your preceding work. All your work on integration, positive emotion, Dharma responsiveness and spiritual death, actively practicing spiritual death. So that's why the poem reminds me of that, because you can't, the experience James Heaney is sort of describing then, that the heart being blown open, you can't make that happen, but you can set up the conditions for it. So even though we can't make it happen, Subhuti argues that we need a connection with that unfolding experience way before it actually arises decisively. And he says if we don't have that, it'll just be so easy to fall back into, well, just a sort of, especially in our culture, nihilistic materialism. And if we don't have that, if we don't have a connection with what enlightenment might be like, even though we can't fully know it, then there's a danger that our very Dharma life can just turn into sort of something a bit mediocre. Yeah, something kind of good, kind of from a humanistic point of view, quite good, but at the same time quite mediocre. That we'd be in danger of ending up settling for making ourselves just a little bit better as a human being, rather than striving for something far beyond that, something that kind of transcends what we usually think of as human, something that transcends that self-clinging. So he argues that we need some sort of connection with that magical, mysterious and creative dimension. And that if we don't have that, then we'll have no object for our Shraddha. Shraddha, as you know, we translate it as faith, but it means, it means faith, certainly not in the blind faith. It literally means placing the heart upon. Yeah, so if we don't have that, we'll have nothing to place our heart upon. And then we'll be thrust back. We just be thrust back on this kind of I, yeah? And at very best, an improvement of I. And in our culture, where we've on the whole rejected the old religions, then that's a danger. So even though we've probably done the right thing in rejecting the old religions, because they ended up getting so literalistic, we're in danger of having thrown the baby out with the bathwater, of just ending up with just simply the material and nothing more. What sort of excited me about listening to these talks by Subbuti and thinking about them is really his emphasis on the fact that we need an object for our Shraddha. I mean, if you think about it, it sort of makes sense. If Shraddha means placing our heart upon something, then we need something to place our heart upon. We can't place our heart on something if there's nothing to place it on. And he says it quite strongly that if there's no object for our Shraddha, there is no Shraddha. If there's no object for our responsiveness, if there's nothing to respond to, then we won't respond. We can't respond. So I find this personally very exciting and stimulating. And true, it makes sense to me. It's what we base, for example, our practice of the Metta Bhavana on, don't we? We ideally, in the end, metta is something that would just flow, yeah. But it'll flow more. Well, we know this, don't we? It flows more if it flows towards somebody or something. That stimulates our metta. When we do the Metta Bhavana practice, we bring to mind people, don't we? And that stimulates a response. And this, what excites me is this is the same for the Buddha himself, both at the beginning of his journey and at the end of his journey, as it were. So Buddhism isn't an abstract thing. There's always a response to something. So at the beginning of the Buddha's journey, before he's the Buddha, what he's responding to, in a way, is his own crisis, really. What he's responding to, the realization of dukkha, of suffering. Buddhism doesn't come out of an idea, it comes out of a direct experience of a young man who realises what is the point of everything if it all ends in death and suffering. But he realises that, he just starts to face that, he's honest enough to face that. So at the beginning of his journey, it begins with a response. Yeah? It doesn't begin with an idea, it doesn't begin with a theory. It doesn't begin with a myth. It begins with an experience, and it begins with the Buddha to be taken that on board and actually responding, actually doing something. That passage from the poem is actually the moment when he does something. He decides, right, I'm going to go forth and try and do something about this. In terms of the Buddha, at the end of his journey, he still responds, or maybe that's not quite the right way to put it, at the end of his journey. But anyway, the Buddha of history is still responding. When we meet the Buddha of history in the scriptures, he's still responding. He's responding to people. Again, he doesn't teach in the abstract. He doesn't just go and sort of preach like people you still sometimes see nowadays, even in this country, sort of just standing on a soapbox and speaking, no matter who's listening. He actually is responding to people. And I think this is really important because it's the people that are drawing out the particular teachings from him. Not even just the teachings, the actual response. You know, that we know, for example, when he meets a grieving mother, in the case of Kissa Gotami in the scriptures, a particular response is drawn out. If he met another different person, another different response would have been drawn out. And so even in the case of an enlightened being, there's something active going on, there's something that gets activated. I know Sandra Ajda talks about this as well in terms of his own teaching. He says that his time in India, his sort of when he was teaching there, before he even started the movement as we know it, he thinks that that was, or he sees that as a particularly creative time in his Dharma life, and it was because the situation and the people there were drawing more from him than was ever drawn before or since. Yeah, so that was, it was drawing something out of him. So again, you've got this very dynamic thing going on. So I get very excited about all this because it's the Dharma is something, it's an alive thing, it's a living thing, its transmission is a living thing from person to person. It's, and actually that's echoed right down into the ordination ceremonies themselves. They're a living thing that happen between people. So if there's no object for our Shraddha, according to Subhuti, there is no Shraddha, that might be worth pondering on. It might be worth asking yourself that. Do you think that's true? He says, if there's no object for our responsiveness, we can't respond. And if we can't respond, we fall back.
You can say that this is what we've got to do first and foremost, is we've got to, before we even think of ordination or not or anything, just even to sort of live a human life with human values, we need an object for our Shraddha. We need something. We need something of value that will allow us to wake up our responsiveness, to wake up our sense of something we can put our heart on. And we need something, ultimately we need something that won't let us down. And the only thing that won't let us down, in Dharmic terms, is what Subhuti calls a transcendental object. So we need something to place our heart upon, but we need to do that. We need something that we can entrust our heart to, something that won't let us down. So I want to talk a lot about that, because it sounds like a lot of a strange term, actually, a transcendental object, because it can sound at first hearing a bit of a contradiction in terms, because when we talk about the transcendental, we talk about transcending the distinction between subject and object. So it's a bit of a paradox. I'm just going to say a little bit, I think this isn't too technical, just about the nature of our experience. Just to sort of go into this paradox a wee bit. So, what the nature of our experience is, actually it's not that complicated really. We've got an inward perceiving aspect and we've got an outward perceiving aspect. So, for example, we've got all our senses. So our eye, for example, sees an object, and our consciousness of that object's got an inward bit, and then it's got the outer bit, which is the object itself. Yeah, and that's true for all of us, whether we're Buddhas, enlightened beings, or not. Anybody who's got eyes to see will have that. Will have the inner side, the females and so forth, they're more on the inner side, and then in the case of an object, the colour and shape and so forth, they're more on the outer side. But what we do is we take the raw data of our experience and we impose on it a construction that there are actually real fixed, there is a real fixed subject, that perceives, has an experience of a real fixed object, yeah? And it's not just an abstract idea about that. We really, really get very, very emotionally invested in that. We care about it. And we care about this idea of ourselves that we have read into our experience. So we care about all those elements that we consider to be an external world, and we want them to make us, we try and sort of fix that in sort of a way that will make us feel safe and happy and comfortable, yeah? And so we draw things towards us that we think will make us safe and happy and comfortable, and we try and push away and reject and fear and hate the elements that threaten us, yeah? And in that way, we fix what we experience as I in here and what we experience as the world out there into real and mutually exclusive reality, so sort of separateness, and between which there's this powerful connection, either a connection of attraction to things we think will make us safe, or the connection of repulsion. So repulsion's still a connection because we care, yeah? So that's where we start from, this fixed I and this fixed world and this strong, powerful, magnetic, emotional connection of attraction and repulsion. That's where we start, and that is, it's easy to think that is the, it's easy to kind of problematize that, yeah? We often kind of immediately think, oh no, you know, I'm getting too attached, I need to sort of not get attached, and what am I going to do about this fact that I get all attached and I get all full of hatred and everything? So it's easy to, it's easy to problematize that, but what Subhuti's advising is just to, not so much to problematize it, but just to acknowledge it. And then, well, it's not just Subhuti that's saying this, actually, it's been said all through the tradition. But to try and work with these forces in a more creative way. Instead of problematizing them, to try and redirect them. So to redirect the flow of all of our volitions, so that they'll support our efforts to live a Dharma life, yeah? So that's one way you could, that's a way that I find very helpful to look at it. So you're working within this framework, and you're in this framework of the I, all the things you love, all the things you hate. You've got a bit of a glimpse that there's something, there could be something outside that. There is such a thing as Buddhahood, there is such a thing as being free from that piece of elastic that's constantly drawing you back to I. But we know we can't force that out, we can't just get to it, we can't just sort of leap into it. But what we can do is we can work with the forces, we can work with the powerful attractions within the framework to take us out of the framework, yeah? So we're working within it. I'm trying to find within our experience something that can be an object for the attractions, all these attractions that we feel that can take us outside that framework. So the first thing we have to do is to find this natural attraction in the first place. Then we've got to find something that points beyond it. So I think the first thing we've got to do in the very first place is to sort of wake up this sense of natural attraction. And because I think this capacity to respond to value that we've all got can get kind of buried, it can get obscured, and it can get, um, it can thinking, well, sometimes we can, I know in myself I can even be a bit frightened of it. I can be frightened of the strength of my own positivity even. So I think one thing to do, the first step is to try and sort of wake up that capacity that we've got to respond, especially to respond to value. And probably you've, I imagine that any of you who've been practicing meditation and the Dharma for any length of time whatsoever have already noticed that that's already happened. That one way to measure isn't quite the right word, but even sort of see our Dharma practices, see how it has wakened up, for example, our capacity to respond to even quite simple things like the beauty of nature, the beauty of art, and our connection with other people, for example, an ability to empathise with other people's suffering and be moved by their positive qualities, like their bravery, for example, or anything positive we see in them, their sort of nobility in other people. So we can, first of all, we can wake up that capacity to respond to value. And then we can start to direct it more consciously towards, the Buddha's calling it some transcendental, more consciously towards something transcendental. So you can use the power of that ordinary attraction to draw you beyond attraction. You can, it's almost like you can use that sense. You can use the eye to mold your experience beyond the eye. You can use your objects of attraction to take you beyond objects. So he gives the example of when you're attracted to a piece of music, for example. If it's a genuine, if you're genuinely moved by it, then your first response to it is often quite inarticulate. And I think that's good in a way, that it is inarticulate. But again, like in the poem, if you remember that line, Shane Skeeny says, useless to think you'll park and try and capture it. Yeah, you can't take a photograph of it. It's an inarticulate response. It's almost like you don't know why you're responding. It's like you've been caught by something, a bit like catching the heart off guard. So it's just it's allowing for that. It can start off with quite ordinary things, but then you're always looking for within the ordinary a gleam or a glisten or a reflection of what goes beyond it. And you could see that the art of the Dharma life is finding those things that glimmer with the something beyond, even if it's just a little bit beyond. In a way, it's very kind of, I mean, you could say it's quite a sort of simple method. It's like we've got the mechanism, but it's by virtue of being human, we've got this capacity to respond. I was thinking that's probably one of the things that makes human beings human, is a capacity to respond to value. We've all got that. We've all got it. But what we can do is we can wake it up more fully. And then we can start to direct it more and more to the direction of something of higher and higher value, would be one way of putting it. Something that's, you're directing it more and more to, when I say the transcendental, what I mean is you're directing it more and more towards something that is limitless. So you take that capacity and you direct it to something that's more and more that is more and more limitless. And you can do that quite consciously in the Dharma life by a quite straightforward way really of doing that is by thinking of the Buddha himself, yeah? So the Buddha can represent, the Buddha does represent for us a human being that through his own efforts realised enlightenment. So what we can do quite simply is just cultivate our connection with the Buddha. The Buddha can become that transcendental object. We can do that by reading about him. Well, when I say thinking about him, just sort of imagining the Buddha. We can do that by imagining the Buddha. So we can access our natural responsiveness and direct it. And if we do that, a sort of quite a magical thing happens because it will feel like at the same time as we're directing our responsiveness towards the Buddha, that the Buddha is kind of drawing us towards him, almost like the Buddha's kind of, almost like there's a sort of, the Buddha's got a hook, as it were, that's drawing us towards him. It kind of sounds simple, but I think it is quite a delicate sort of subtle process. It's a sort of craftsman-like process. There's actually a word in Buddhism called kusala, which means skillful, and it really is a skill to do that. We're trying to really pay attention to what really does move us, and then coax that in the direction of something transcendental. So you can't do that in a crude way. You've really got to start from the inside out. You've got to say, well, what really does move me? And then allow that to unfold, but at the same time, you've got to give it some direction, a bit like in Shema Sini's poem, he has actually got to drive out waste. You can't just, on one hand, you've got to allow it to unfold, but at the same time, you can't always just wait for it, you can't just make no effort for that to happen. You've got to make some effort, but the effort can't be a forcing sort of effort. So it's quite subtle, and it does require you to be sort of true to yourself. I was talking to a friend today, and she was realising that it's almost like she had been practicing almost like kind of beside herself. She'd taken this idea of what she thought her Dharma life should be, mainly by looking at other people and seeing what was inspiring them and almost trying to graft that onto herself. And she was just saying to me today, she said, "So Bhairamati, I've run out of petrol. Like, I can't do that anymore. I can't take someone else's idea of what's inspiring and graft it onto myself." And so I was, as we were talking today, I was saying to her, and she was saying, we were having to get to, well, what is inspiring for you? And she said, other people, she said, being kind to other people. She said, I know that's true. I know that's inspiring for me, and I know that's true. So we were just saying, right, start there. You've got to start there. You've got to start with what really is true for you. But then we're saying, you know, she's going to have to put some effort in. I mean, I'm saying her. I could equally as well be talking to myself. We're going to have to put effort in to think, well, how am I going to flourish that? How am I going to allow that to grow? And this is the work. So this is the work. When someone asks to be ordained, we say that the sort of embark on ordination framework. I never really quite like that phrase, although I can't really think of something better, because I don't know, it's in danger of making it sound like, well, it's just you just do this and you just go on these retreats and then you just, you know, do this study and then you'll be ready and then you get ordained. Whereas actually the process is much more subtle. It's much more, that's why this word kusala comes in. It's much more, you're going to have to use much more skill, well, in a sense, whether you want to get ordained or not. Really, to live a human life, it's a matter of that. But if you do want to get ordained, there's quite a subtle process, yes, which is going to be first contact, and well, how do I respond? What are my values? And at the same time, you bring that to life, but then you have to think, well, what is going to represent that transcendental object for me? So I'm saying the Buddha, but I don't mean that in that you're going to sort of sit and gaze and say this particular statue, for example. You're going to have to say, well, what does an enlightened being mean for me? How does the Buddha speak to me? How does the Buddha manifest for me, appear for me? And how can I kind of coax what was of value to me towards something that I believe is transcendent, yeah, goes beyond the mundane. So that's what the work is. Yeah, we need to contact our own responsiveness, and at the same time, we need a transcendental object for that, something to place our heart upon that's psychically charged. If we don't have that, then the Dharma will just turn into just ideas. And our practice of the Dharma will just be creating a sort of nicer version of ourselves, which I suppose is better than a less nice version of ourselves. But still, it's far short of what it could be. If we don't have that, yeah, we just add something on to our ordinary consumerist lifestyle. So in the private ordination ceremony, you're committing to being spiritually reborn. Yeah? That's what you're committed to. That's what you're doing when you chant those refuges, even though you've chanted them before, Bhutan Saranangachami, Dhamman Saranangachami, Sangham Saranangachami. You're openly declaring yourself to be committed to spiritual rebirth and committed to working towards that transcendental object. And ordination's confirming that connection. It's confirming that connection with the Buddha, whoever the Buddha means, however you experience the Buddha, becomes the lodestone of your life, the compass that points you. I really like that image, that the Buddha is the compass that points you. So that that's what we were doing when we were up on that mountain. That's what those women, and some of whom you'll meet in 2 weeks' time, four of whom you'll meet in 2 weeks' time, were doing when they took part in the ordination ceremony. That's what they've been training for all that time, 4 years or 5 years or 10 years or even 30 years, to be able to be witnessed in making that step of having accessed all that responsiveness and found something that they could place their heart upon, and were witnessed in doing that. So I hope that's given a little taste of this mysterious ritual, and a little taste of the mystery, and a little taste particularly of the sort of subtlety and skill that's involved in trying to do that, and it certainly doesn't stop ordination itself. I always feel a bit embarrassed when someone's, you know, I have to own up to being ordained for 19 years, because I always feel such a newcomer at it all myself. But I think I'll leave it there, and next week Jan Bart is going to talk to us more about what ordination means. So thank you for your time.